Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on Australian bushfires history with our two speakers who I'll introduce very briefly. Dr. Jennifer Maharasi is a senior fellow at the Institute of Public Affairs. She has a Bachelor of Science degree and a PhD, and her early work in her undergraduate degree was in botany and ecology. And we have Paul Collins, who I think it's fair to say is not a senior fellow at the IPA. I think that's fair to say that. He's described himself as a bit of a lefty greenie, actually. Anyway, he's very welcome here. Both our speakers make a welcome return. Paul describes himself, well, Paul's a historian, and he writes on Catholicism, and I'm getting to that, and he's also the author of, Anne's just taken it, Burn. He's also the author of Burn, the epic story of bushfires in Australia, and that's recently been republished by Scribe. And of course, Jennifer's also the author of chapters and books as well. So off we go today. We're going to start with Jennifer, and then we go to Paul. They're both going to speak for about 15 minutes each, and then we come to questions and discussion. Jennifer, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much to the Sydney Institute, to Anne and Jared, for the opportunity to be here this evening and to talk about bushfire history. I'd also like to talk a little bit about the rewriting of climate history. And in particular, I'd actually like to contrast best practice conservation as understood by lefty greenies versus best practice conservation as understood by the first people of this nation, by Aboriginal Australians. And for the Australian Aboriginal, wilderness was not a cause for fond nostalgia, but a land without custodians. There are two very different philosophies that we need to start discussing and deciding which has primacy, which is the most important, which will give us the best environmental outcomes. Because these two philosophies, to a large extent, are incompatible. And certainly the balance of nature philosophy is not a scientific one. It is perhaps relevant that I grew up in the Northern Territory of Australia, that my very first memories are of wildflowers emerging from ground still ashen from a bushfire, and of swimming with Indigenous friends at Kamali Creek in that billabong. The information that I will present tonight has also been informed by two colleagues, a botanist and an ecologist, Dr. David Ward and Dr. Bill Burrows, from Western Australia and from Queensland. But let me begin by quoting from a report from right back in 1939. Let me quote from Judge Streeton following that terrible fire in Victoria. "The rich plains denied their beneficial rains lay bare and baking, and the forests from the foothills to the alpine heights were tinder. The soft carpet of the forest floor was gone. The bone dry litter crackled underfoot. Dry heat and hot winds worked upon a land already dry to suck from it the last least drop of moisture. Men who had their lives in the bush went their way in the shadow of dread expectancy. But though they felt the imminence of danger, they could not tell that it was to be far greater than they could imagine. They had not lived long enough. The experience of the past could not guide them to an understanding of what might and did happen. I'm quoting from Judge Leonard Streeton's report of that Royal Commission into the bushfires that consumed 2 million hectares of Victoria back in 1939. This last summer, 1.4 million hectares burnt in Victoria. More extensive areas burnt in southern New South Wales. A reported 5.2 million hectares to the 10th of January 2020. It has been claimed that this 5.2 million hectares is unprecedented in extent, except that somewhere in the vicinity of 7.2 million hectares burnt during the summer of 1951-52. I'm referring to a CSIRO report entitled The Bushfire History of the South Coast Study Area, and it details fires at Beegan, Nowra, Mount Dromoley and other parts of southern New South Wales. And then there were terrible fires again in this region in 1994. These are vast areas, 5.2 million hectares, 7.2 million hectares, 1.4 million hectares. But let's put them in perspective relative to what happens in northern Australia, and I am from the north. 117 million hectares of central northern Australia burnt in 1974-75. That's according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics special report on bushfires published in 1995. 117 million. There is no consistent Australian-wide methodology for determining even the area burnt. Since 2011, the Commonwealth has published state of forest reports every 5 years. The largest unplanned area burnt, according to this report, in a single year was 12 million hectares in Queensland in 2012-2013. But it is the wildfires that most impact our built environments that are most remembered. And to continue with Justice Streeton from his report, townships were obliterated in a few minutes. Back in 1939, townships were obliterated in a few minutes. On that day, it appeared that the whole state of Victoria was alight. At midday, in many places, it was dark as night. Men carried lanterns, worked to make safe their families and belongings. Travellers on the highway were trapped by fire or blazing fallen trees and perished. Throughout the land, there was daytime darkness. This last summer, we witnessed through live streaming on social media the seaside town of Mallacoota in East Gippsland become as dark as night. One morning, engulfed in a firestorm. Back in 1939, Judge Streeton made reference to the shortness of a single man's experience, how he may not have lived long enough to experience such infernos. Nowadays, the word unprecedented, is generally applied to destructive climate-related events. It's as though history is irrelevant and that all these climate-related events could not have been predicted and have never happened before. The Prime Minister of Australia, Scott Morrison, has gone as far as to claim the recent bushfires were caused by hotter and drier summers. And I have some charts, which I'm hoping are going to be shown as part of this broadcast, that actually query that. Because the data doesn't suggest summers are actually getting hotter or drier, certainly not relative to the 1930s in Australia or the US. Remember John Steinbeck's book, The Graps of Wrath? Yeah. And the dust storms and the heat, and we have a temperature record from back then. And we have temperature records from places like Rutherglen and Victoria. And they show that the heat back then was really exceptional, really unprecedented. In fact, it could be the case that fires this last summer have nothing to do with climate change and everything to do with the current zeitgeist, which embraces a romantic balance of nature myth that makes appropriate hazard reduction burning so difficult. It is the case that for a forest to incinerate, it must contain what is referred to in the technical literature as critically high fuel loads. Tasmania, parts of New South Wales and Victoria, and also the southwest corner of Western Australia have the tallest eucalypt forests, which, if not appropriately managed, contain explosive fuel loads, potentially feeding devastating infernos. And in Queensland, it's predicted that the incidence of wildfires will increase given the additional restrictions on hazard reduction burning since the introduction of the Vegetation Management Act in 1999. Every Royal Commission and Coronial Inquiry since 1939, and I understand there's been about 18, have suggested particular hazard reduction targets, but they are never achieved. Rather, as is the case with the Queensland Vegetation Management Act, a premium is placed on any landscape with trees and fire too often prohibited. The Queensland legislation prohibits burning in areas designated remnant, even though this remnant vegetation may be invasive scrub less than 15 years old, replacing once open woodland. There needs to be a national discussion about the implications of this type of legislation. The first ordinance to, and I quote, diminish the dangers from bushfires, because these restrictions on hazard reduction don't begin in 1999 with the Queensland legislation. There were restrictions from as early as 1847 in Western Australia. Soon after this, bushfire acts were legislated in South Australia and Tasmania. A conservator of forests was appointed in Victoria in 1888. His focus was on protecting the state's forests from overcutting, overgrazing, and fire. Protecting from fire. But for our first people, fire was a tool used to create buffer zones. Used to create buffer zones that prevented the spread of fire into particular eucalypt forests. Fire was a tool used to create nested mosaics to reduce the risk of dangerous wildfires. The Noongar people of Western Australia, for example, considered frequent fire their friend, making the bush safe and promoting grass for yonka, for kangaroos. Most of us have very little first-hand experience of such nature. We don't know how to find breakfast in the Australian bush. We don't know the effect of fire on bush tucker plants. We may visit natural environments on our holidays, and we may expect that there is ecological balance. That there is a balance has no, as I said, no basis in the ecological science. This myth has no empirical support. It's not scientific, this idea that if we leave things alone, everything will be okay, will be better. Yet, this concept of a balance of nature, which does not have a scientific basis in ecology and biology, has come to underpin land management across Australia. It assumes, as with the Queensland Vegetation Management legislation, that preventing active land management, including hazard reduction burning, is the best option. This myth, embraced by whitefella culture, by lefties and greenies, is alien to the Aboriginal way. In their dreaming, wilderness, as I said, was never a cause for fond nostalgia, but a land without custodians. It is so important that Australians come to understand this truth. The Aboriginal philosophy of dreaming and the laws derived from the dreaming required active management and real responsibility for country. They required an understanding of country. The first Europeans commented again and again that the land was like a park with extensive grassy patches and pathways, open woodlands and abundant wildlife. There are diary entries about particular landscapes evoking a country estate in England feel. And this is so documented in this biggest estate on earth, How Aborigines Made Australia, a book that I would highly recommend to those who want to try and understand how we may manage our natural landscapes actively, including with fire. As my colleague Dr. David Ward likes to explain, before Europeans arrived, the Noongar people managed the dry forests and woodlands in the far southwest of Western Australia, a region now prone to catastrophic wildfires, without fire trucks, water bombers, helicopters, television journalists, concerned politicians, the Conservation Council, hundreds of firefighters, and the Salvation Army to give them breakfast. At the peak of the recent bushfire crisis, Scott Morrison, our Prime Minister, did say that there was a need for a royal commission into the killer bushfire season, and that that summers had become hotter and drier. And this is also a reason used by fire chiefs for inadequate hazard reduction burning over recent decades. So there is actually data, and I hope it's going to be shown as part of this broadcast. For example, we've got data on rainfall for the southeast of Australia, and it shows, and we've got data for, I'm just looking for my particular chart, that one, which I will be giving to Jared and Anne to show. But let's have a look at the one in front of me, which is Annual Rainfall Australia. And it shows that the first half of the last century was so much drier than the second half. And the temperature data, as I said, shows that the 1930s were particularly hot and particularly dry. And if you look at things like annual heatwave indexes 1895 to 2015, as published by the US Environment Protection Agency, there's been nothing. What was unprecedented occurred a long time ago in terms of that 1930s drought and the hot years. If I best stop in about 3 minutes, I probably haven't got time to go into detail why and how the data is homogenised, and also problems with calibration of equipment today used to measure temperatures in Australia. There's a policy in place, for example, that says when you move from a mercury thermometer in a Stevenson screen to an electronic probe, as has happened at 695 weather recording stations across Australia, you should actually check that the probe's recording as per the mercury thermometer. That's not happening. At most places, they take the probe out on, they take the mercury thermometer out on one day, they put in a probe the same day. The few places where we have parallel data, I have shown, for example, in Mildura, the probes are recording 0.4 degrees hotter for the same weather. Then there's the issue of homogenisation, and I talked about that back in 2014. How even after the temperatures are measured, be it by probe or be it by mercury thermometer, there is this remodelling to create this idea that we have each year hotter than the last. That is the impression from the remodel data. In his book, Dark Emu, Bruce Pascoe takes Bill Gummidge's thesis that land management by Australian Aboriginals was deliberate and sophisticated to a new level. And he actually talks about the sophistication of not only fire management, but also a storing of grain, irrigation practices. And many people say that this is just extraordinary, that this is not, this could not be true. But for me, I have spent so much time looking at the accounts of anthropologists who lived, for example, with the Araldi of the Lower Murray River in the mid-1800s. I read how they salted fish, stored grain, and the complex system of governance for the sustainable harvest of wildlife in what was then a functioning Murray River estuary. In Dark Emu, Pasco explains how the first institutions here in Sydney denied so much Aboriginal culture in accordance with an overarching colonial agenda. Perhaps somewhat like the Bureau remodels our temperature history to create a particular narrative in accordance with a particular agenda. Perhaps the more things change, the more they stay the same. Thank you.
So we go to Paul Collins. Thank you, Paul. Thanks.
Well, no doubt you're wondering what a church historian who specialises in the papacy, because last time I was here I talked about the papacy, what the hell am I doing pontificating on bushfires? Well, I'm much given to pontification, that's the first thing. But the second thing is, my wife and I owned a block down in the Snowy Mountains. We had 424.5 hectares, which in the old terms is about 1,300 acres. And we're up 4,000 feet. And we bought it in November 2002. And there was an old house on it, which any lawyers here, it wasn't authorised. But someone had built it. It was all gone by January 2003, burnt down completely in the 2003 fires. So I said to myself, being a historian, oh, there must be a history of bushfires in Australia. Well, there isn't, or there wasn't. There certainly is now. There was an excellent book by Stephen Pine, an American scientist, but what I wanted to do was to really look at what happened in the past, what has happened in the whole period of European fire in Australia. And Jennifer is absolutely right. The pivotal, in a way, the pivotal year for fire in European Australia is 1939, the Leonard Stretton Royal Commission. An extraordinary judge and an extraordinary Royal Commission. I can claim to be one of only two people who have read through the entire minutes of evidence to that Royal Commission, because by chance I was able to recover it from an office in the Lands Department in Melbourne, which was the only copy left at the time. That's the actual minutes of the Royal Commission. There's now a copy, you'll be pleased to know, in the National Library. I've divided the history of fire in Australia into two general periods, before and after 39. In the period before 39, I look firstly at the squatter period. We all know the history of the squatters. These were ambitious young men, normally second sons, guys on the make, had a few bob in their pockets, and decamped on unoccupied Crown land. They used fire to clear the land. They were only interested in sheep. They were interested in the wool trade. They used fire to clear the land. But if you like, the pivotal fire of the squatter period was one that, again, Jennifer referred to, which is Black Thursday, the 6th of February, 1851, which, exactly as she says, quite correctly, the scale and ferocity was quite extraordinary. Some 5 million hectares were burnt in Victoria. The fire was really focused largely in Victoria, which of course wasn't Victoria at that stage. It was still part of New South Wales. Then came the gold rushes, and with the gold rushes came an enormous increase in the Australian population. The Australian population in 1850 was 405,000 people. In 1861, it was 1.16 million people. So in that 10 years, the population had more than doubled. Of course, very few of them struck gold. And so they were at a loss. The land acts in the various colonies, particularly New South Wales and Victoria, were passed in order to give these people, the selectors, land. And of course, often they selected the best land on the squatters' run, which of course led to conflict. And of course, no one more romantic than Henry Lawson to write The Fire at Ross's Farm, where in the end, because the squatter's son was in love with the selector's daughter, in the end, they saved the selector's farm from the fire. Fire became absolutely intense in the selector period. This was how the land was cleared. They developed this whole mentality that you burnt land in a key, hot, windy day. And then it became a wildfire. And then you had to put it out, but then you had to burn more land in order that that wouldn't happen again. And so what has happened in Australian history is this interaction between burning to clear, and burning to stop burning. And if you like the pivotal fire of that period, of the selector period, is the fire of Red Tuesday. Doesn't get mentioned much, this one. It was a fire largely in Gippsland in Victoria. It was an area that had been cleared by selectors. It was one of the largest stands of cool temperate rainforest on Earth. Originally, that stand went right across Bass Strait. Yes, Bass Strait was flooded in about 12,000 years ago, but it went right across and down to the southwest of Tasmania. Jennifer is right. It was associated with drought. It was associated with the Federation drought from 1895 to 1903. And about 500,000 hectares of cool temperate rainforest were destroyed in that. But again, this interaction between wildfire and preventative fire starts to come to the surface. This is a potted history, so I'm going to jump from 1901 to 1939 fairly quickly. Generally, the fires in that period in the eastern states were usually bush or forest fires, but in outback Queensland and in outback New South Wales, in northern South Australia, in northern Western Australia and the Northern Territory, they were vast, fast-moving and unpredictable grass and savanna fires. But what happens in that period is that, if you like, a kind of pyromania enters into the Australian, particularly the Australian male consciousness. Lighting fires became an ingrained habit across Australia, and there was little or no legal control over what people did. At the 1939 the Royal Commission, one of the men representing the Melbourne and Metropolitan Board of Works at that Royal Commission was A.E. Kelso, Alexander Edward Kelso. And Kelso tells a story to the Royal Commission about how he was walking through the bush with a bushman, and it was a boiling hot day with a high wind, and periodically as the bushman went along, he pulled out his matches and struck a match and threw it into the bush, and a bit of a fire came up. And then they went on for about another kilometre or two, and they did the same thing. And in the end, Kelso, who was, was a bit concerned about this, said to him, "What the hell are you doing?" And he said, "I'm letting my boss know where I am." So he was using smoke signals. Now, the Stretton Royal Commission followed Black Friday in Victoria, which was the 13th of January 1939. It was preceded by drought, And wildfires swept across Victoria, southern New South Wales, including the Snowy Mountains, burning 2 million hectares and killing 71 people. Now, the result of that was a country party government, a very tenuous country party government in Victoria at the time. They appointed Leonard Stretton as Royal Commissioner. And Stretton held hearings all around the state. He went to where the bushfires had been. He actually held a session in the pub at Kinglake in Victoria. And he was the first to challenge what he called the burn, burn, burn mentality. And Kelso, who was legal counsel, even though he was actually not a lawyer, he was an engineer, he was legal counsel on behalf of the Melbourne Metropolitan Board of Works. And the MNMBW, which is one of the first, interestingly, one of the first organisations of its kind in the world, believed that the dams around Melbourne were to be protected by intact forests. And they were absolutely determined that there was to be no burning in the forest, there was to be no logging in these forests. And so the evidence that he gave is summed up by Stretton when Stretton says, in pre-European times, the forests had not been scourged by fire. They were in their natural state. Their canopies had prevented the growth of scrub and bracken. They were safe. Then came the Europeans. They destroyed the canopy by logging and burned forests to clear land. They burned the floor to promote the growth of grass and to clear it of scrub. But the balance of nature had been broken, and fire encouraged scrub growth far more. When fire was used to clear it, the scrub grew faster and thicker. And again, the cleansing agent, fire, was used. In other words, he's describing a vicious circle. Now, the Stretton Royal Commission in many ways was, really neglected. And the war came, Second World War came, and it wasn't until post-1945 that people started to study fire seriously. And two of the first to do that were Alan MacArthur and another bloke named Harry Luke. And MacArthur and Luke wrote the textbook, really, called Bushfires in Australia. It was published in 1978. Now, they are very concerned about reducing the fuel load. They were primarily focused on the economic value of landscape, not on environmental issues, let alone on native flora and fauna. And this book became, if you like, the Bible, right up until the late 20th century. Interestingly, many of the fires, the major fires of this period, the post-1945, were on the urban frontier, and many were deliberately lit by arsonists. I got into a terrible scrape with the bloke from the Civil Liberties in Queensland, I can't think of his name, when I said that... Terry O'Gorman, thank you. I said that anybody who was suspected by the police of being an arsonist, with a judge's permission, ought to have to wear a bracelet so that we knew where they were during the worst period of fire. Oh, Terry got into me for that, I'll tell you. Luckily, I've got a very thick hide. So these are the days of Black Tuesday in Hobart on the 7th of February 1967, when the fire came right into the suburb of Dunurn, which is an inner Hobart suburb. It's just actually where the expressway goes down to Kingston, just out of Hobart. It burnt the brewery, that's right, my God. That's a tragedy.
National tragedy.
Absolute national, well, yes. But of course, they're very sober in Tasmania. With Ash Wednesday, which of course is, you know, a fire that everybody seems to remember, mainly in Victoria and South Australia, 103 people killed, 2,000 homes destroyed, and then Black Saturday in Victoria in 2009. I'm putting that in this group of fires because it is, a more restricted fire to one state. And the interesting thing about Black Saturday is that it pretty much followed the trajectory of the 39 fire. It began a bit to the west and it ended up a good bit further to the east, but it went right across through King Lake, over the hills there and down to the east. Now, I do have to say that I think when we come on, and of course I don't want to forget the Canberra fire, that, of course, was 2003, but I mentioned that fire at the beginning when we got burnt out. So who cares about Canberra? I do, because I live there. But when we come to the fires that we have just experienced, I think we have entered a new era of fire. It is to do, in my view at any rate, with global warming, but I don't think that's the only element in this equation. I think what is happening now is that we are reaping the results of 230 years of massive dislocation and vandalism in the landscape. And the results have been disastrous. Non-Aboriginal Australia has defied nature, and now nature's responding, and in my view, we cannot continue in this way. I think we have to rethink our whole approach to the landscape and to our place in it, and for me, the priority, if we have to decide on priorities, for me, the priority is the integrity of the landscape, the protection of biodiversity. These, to me, the survival of species, to me, takes priority over everything, including human assets. I say that simply because we won't have anywhere to live if we don't do something about our attitude to the landscape. I want to just finish. How am I going for time?
You're doing fine.
Okay, how many?
Three.
Right. Wow. You can see I'm used to preaching sermons, you see. You know, we Catholics have brief sermons, if you talk too long in the Catholic Church, you soon get told. I just want to say a few words about Aboriginal fire management, which again Jennifer touched on. Now, I think I'm in two minds about it, I have to say. I know Bill Gammage very, very well. He's an old colleague, historian colleague of mine, and Bill and I have agreed to differ on one or two things. I have not read the other book that you referred to. What's the guy's name?
Bruce
Pascoe's book. I haven't read that, so I'm not in a position to speak. But I think we have to understand first what were Aborigines trying to do before 1788. They weren't trying to improve the land, they weren't farming it in a modern sense, but they were trying to maintain, according to their cosmology, stasis in the landscape, stability in the landscape. Bill Stannard, who perhaps understands Aboriginal cosmology and religion better than anybody, speaks of the dreaming as every when. That is, they have no sense of continuity. They have no sense of history as progress. They have a sense of stability. And for them, they traditionally burnt the open grassland and savannah, and because each part of the continent was different, their approach to it was different, and they certainly knew their own country intimately. But I just want to make one point about Aboriginal burning. The real problem is, we can learn from them, I do not deny that for a moment, but the real problem is the country has changed radically. There were about 750,000, give or take, a couple of hundred thousand Aborigines in Australia in 1788. The present population is 25.3 million, which creates a vastly different situation. Secondly, the landscape has been modified and changed on a vast scale, so we are literally dealing with a different country. So I have some real problems with the Aboriginal fire regime. I think we can learn something, but I'm not sure that it's the whole answer. The real changes, I think, that have to occur are attitudinal. We have to change our attitudes to the landscape.
Well, thanks very much to Dr. Marahasi and to Dr. Collins. And so we're coming to question discussion time. A lot of people here, got to keep your comments short. And I think we just directed to one person, not to two, and we'll get through more. And I will operate the microphone here, and I'll get Anne to operate it there. Yep. Okay, so just start off, if you just both come up here, and Paul, all right, Paul, if you just, and you just talk into the microphone. So just start with Paul. You got into trouble with Terry O'Gorman with your suggestions about how to handle arsonists. So it seems you've got it underneath there somewhere, a kind of authoritarian streak. So,
oh, absolutely.
Would you bring about a situation where people are prevented from settling in from what we know are essentially fire areas? Because with the growth of population, more and more people are moving into more fire areas. So just comment briefly on that.
A very brief comment. One of the most interesting things is to fly in from Canberra on the Dash 8 to Sydney, especially when it comes in over the southern area there. You can see ridge lines with bush coming up on both sides and a street going along and houses on the street, and it's a dead end. You can find exactly the same thing in the Adelaide Hills, in the Dandenongs, in Melbourne, in Victoria, in around Mount Wellington and in the Blue Mountains, Mount Wellington in Hobart. My view, and you go down the New South Wales coast, villages on the coast with one street in, already we're getting to the snug point. Snug is a small town in Tasmania. In 67, people had to take refuge in the sea. I think if you want to live in those conditions, one, you can't expect other people to risk their lives to come in and help you, and secondly, you should pay the insurance premium.
Maybe, Paul, do you want to make a brief response?
Perhaps the big risks are adjacent public lands, and perhaps those lands could be managed in such a way that there is a buffer between them and the townships that you referenced. And it would be interesting to look at those treed ridges that you're talking about now and see what they actually looked like back in 1788 and think about whether biodiversity values have improved with the trees that are there now, or whether there was perhaps more biodiversity when there were fewer trees going back pre-European settlement. So I think that we can actually apply evidence to these situations. We can say, well, are there more trees now than there were 100 years ago, 300 years ago? And where are most of the trees? Who's managing them? And can they do a better job? And in most cases, the real risks are from public lands that are not appropriately managed.
Okay. Richard? Yes. Just come up. Don't go away. Paul? You go.
Jennifer, my house in the Blue Mountains was...
Not on. Push your card up.
Right. My house in...
Okay. You're gone, yes.
Is in Blue Mountains was approached by the Gosper Mountain Fire, and it came up onto our property. That fire started with lightning. So many of the other fires that occurred during this season seem to be in locations where it could not possibly have been lightning, but looks like it is a lot of arson. Do you think that is right? What's the balance between natural starts and arson starts? And, of course, it's too big a question to ask. What do you do to stop arsonists? It looks like we've had one good idea on that tonight.
So I have had a little look to see if I can understand what the statistics are, and it seems quite confused in terms of getting good data in terms of percentage caused by arson versus, say, lightning strikes. I think that that discussion is largely irrelevant, because if we had proper management, nested hierarchies and mosaics, for example, in the Blue Mountains, we could contain fires that were lit by arsonists. I don't think we should be frightened, actually, of arsonists lighting fires to the extent that we are. If we had proper land management, nested mosaics, buffers, proper control burning, we had diversity, we understood the nature of fire and the nature of the landscape, they wouldn't be the risk that they are today.
Now, I know Paul's written about this in your book, Burn, so perhaps you make a brief comment on the arson issue.
I don't agree that the majority of these fires were arson lit. Arson fires are all on the urban bush interface. That's where they occur. I mean, arsonists do not go out into the middle of the snowy mountains. The fire that I experienced began in the Bay Adbo wilderness from a lightning strike. The Gosper Mountain fire, of course, was a fire that was closed because the national park is very close to habitation. In fact, it surrounds you, as I understand it, almost. So I'm far less critical of land management people. I mean, land management people are often working with very limited budgets to begin with. One of the big problems in Australia, and this astonishes both American and Canadian firefighters who come here, we do not have remote wilderness area firefighters trained. That's what happened in Canberra. The fire was in the Brindabellas was too inaccessible for the firefighters to get into it. That's how it gained its traction. The other interesting thing on the clearing, the Carnell government in the ACT, I found an article in the Canberra Times, some 2 years before the Canberra fires in 2001, the Carnell government wanted to clear back pine forests, which had been planted in the 1920s and 30s, to clear them back at least 500 metres. They came right up to Eucombeen Drive, for instance, in Duffy, if you know the area. Kate Carnell wanted to clear them back. The residents refused. There are residents protesting. There's a picture of them. People do live in cloud cuckoo land in lots of ways. You can't live in the bush with the gum leaves right around you and not expect to have some trouble.
There's a question down there.
Question probably to Paul.
You've got to speak into the microphone.
Sorry.
Go on.
Yep.
You were saying that people should not live where in dangerous areas. People in this state, at least, build houses where they are allowed to build them by councils and government planning. We don't all pop out and build a house just where we would like to. And I think, sure, individuals need to be careful, but it's got to come back to government and planning to get these resources determined.
I don't have any dispute with that.
Okay, so we'll go here to Grant.
Thanks, Derek. Christian, before, you haven't referred to the Black Saturday Royal Commission in Victoria, which recommended, as I understand it, that 5% of Crown land and National Park be cool burnt every year to reduce fuel. Are you disputing that would be a good recommendation? Now, some people would say it's not enough, and by the way, it wasn't done for many years, not even a third of it in recent years. But what's your view on that recommendation?
Well, in some ways, I think Jennifer probably knows more about that than I do, but there is a brief introductory chapter on the 2010 fires, yeah, in the book. We only put it in.
Just come to the microphone.
Okay. We only put it in because the publisher wanted it. And so my study of that Royal Commission is very cursory, I have to say that. I'm not opposed to preventative burning. I'm not opposed to it. I do not think anything is... but I want to try to recover something of the natural stasis. Here I'm using that word again. The stasis of the forests, if you like. Because Australian forests were self-protective. The intact canopy made sure that there was a dark undercover. It did not allow the growth of... and was also very... It kept its moisture. That stopped the growth of the type of stuff that burns. That in many ways is right at the core of my argument.
And I would dispute that. I would actually say that the ecological basis for those claims do not exist, and that the only part of Australia that did not burn going back pre-European settlement were the rainforests of North Queensland, that you can move from a wet sclerophyll to a rainforest situation if you, for example, exclude particular types of fire. But if you want to move back to that situation, you also actually have to look at how you're going to manage that forest, whether you're going to thin it in its early times, because at the moment we've got a lot of monoculture that comes in after big fires, no capacity for proper canopy, unless you actually put some fires in so that you actually create a situation such that some big trees can get established and at appropriate densities to get canopy going. So you can actually use fire to develop a particular forest type, and then you can exclude fire and let it go to the next stage. But this requires a different approach and a different, just leaving any part of the public lands in the southeast and far southwest of Australia alone today will not bring you back to the types of forests that Streeton were referring to, because those forests had been actively created over millennia by Aboriginal Australians, and they're very sophisticated land management techniques that extended beyond random burning with fire.
That's you're not actually contesting that. I mean, you're talking about a degree of clearing. Just a very brief response.
Yeah, I don't think I'm contesting it. I just want to make the point that nature protects itself. It doesn't need human management. But, of course, we have so interfered with it, as Jennifer says, that we do have to... I'm not disagreeing.
Well, the Indigenous people of the Blue Mountains, for example, they will say that the wilderness is not... something that one should aspire to, because it is a land without custodians and it will become potentially explosive and dangerous. So the dreaming mythology is actually at odds with the balance of nature concept, and your ecological sciences and your land management science and your study of the development of different forest types to climax is also at odds with the balance of nature concept.
Now, we're getting very close to the end, so we've got to be very brief. There's a question there, okay? Okay, we've just got to move. Come on.
Hello.
Yep.
Here.
Yeah, just go.
Climate change, what's the big deal about whether it's current, whether it's anthropogenic or not? What's the big deal?
Okay, we got it. So the question is, what's the big deal about climate change in relation to the topic of fires, since Australia's producing 1.3% of emissions? We got it. Okay. Response? Yeah. Cool. Jennifer, you go first.
Well, I think that if it is true that every year is hotter than the last, which is what is being suggested through the remodel data, and given the extent to which a rainfall deficit and low humidity and high temperatures will create situations where, you know, these forests, when you have high fuel loads, will essentially explode, then climate change could be an issue, except that we are not being honest to our temperature history. It's being remodeled. So we need to be both honest to the temperature history to understand that actually we have had hotter and drier periods in the past. And we also need to be honest to the land management history over millennia. And we're honest to neither, and yet we consider ourselves an evidence-based, sophisticated society and civilization.
Paul?
My answer is simple. It's not a question of course there have been temperature goes up and down all the time. Of course it does. It's a question of an increase over a period of time. The Australian the temperature in Australia has increased on average by a little over 1 degree Celsius since 1910. That is quite significant. It has to be looked at over the long term. It's not just a matter of looking at it piecemeal. So I think that climate change is absolutely central to this issue. Purposely not. Emphasised it for the simple reason that I didn't want the whole discussion to get caught in this, because I think there are a whole lot of other issues lurking here. But I nail my flag to the mast. I accept the scientific consensus as I understand it, but I'm a historian and I'm not in a position to judge. I simply accept the consensus that I hear.
Okay, so there's a question down here. I think it'll be the last one. So, yeah, we've got to be brief. Okay?
I was raised in Chicago.
Speak up.
I was raised as a child and a young person in Tobago, and our house was burnt, just exploded into flames. And people who moved there, I would say, disrespected the advice of older people who lived in the area. And we had told the people who bought our house not to plant trees near the house or bushes. They did that. The house exploded into flames and they lost used to be our house. How do you make city-based people who have moved to the country respect the experience of country people?
So we'll ask, we'll go in the reverse way, and we'll ask Paul, who spoke second, to speak first in the conclusion. Right. So you're a sort of man from the country these days.
No, I'm not. I'm a city-based person. And I had a...
Well, you got some nice photos on the wall, haven't you?
We do, yeah. But I had the dream of the country block. The country soon taught me that that dream had certain problems going with it. Look, I absolutely agree with you. The wisdom is that if for any habitation, you should be clearing. You should clear back 400 or 500 metres. And I don't have any problem with that. If you want to live in the bush, you need to protect yourself. You're absolutely right. There is a wisdom and experience there that people have. But it's hard to teach city slickers things.
Final comment,
Jennifer? I think it's about whether we accept that there is a role for active management of the landscape to develop. To see a forest through to very high conservation value, high biodiversity values, whether that's best achieved through active management, and Indigenous Australians would say yes, that as a custodian of country, you should always actively manage it. You should have access into national park areas. There should be, not every area may be burnt all the time, but you should be thinking about which areas you are and aren't going to burn. There should be active management to achieve high biodiversity values. At the moment, that's not accepted. We get these recommendations from royal commissions that say there should be more hazard reduction burning, but they're not owned by the people that need to do that. And the people that need to do the hazard reduction burning are not adequately resourced either. Because fundamentally, the zeitgeist of our time is that we should be leaving these areas alone. But that's not, in my opinion, and that's not what the evidence, and that's not either what our long history would suggest is the best way to manage this great land.
Okay, many thanks. Look, we could go on all night, but we don't. So I just want to say many thanks to Dr. Mauro Hussey and Dr. Collins for a terrific discussion, looking at Australian bushfires from two different perspectives, agreeing on some issues, disagreeing on other issues, which is really what we're about here at the Sydney Institute. And we've had an important reflection on contemporary problems and a very detailed assessment of historical matters both before and after 1788. So we're very grateful to both our speakers tonight. They've been here before. I'm sure they'll be back again. But for tonight, well done and thank you. Thank you, Paul.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.